dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Many Americans, perhaps most, hold a variety of factually unsupported beliefs about the United States. Among them, that our military is used to defend our freedom and that of others, that democracy and capitalism are inseparable, and that the so-called free market is free. Government officials lie about their motives, and our so-called free press disseminates those positions as uncritically as the state media of any totalitarian nation. When was the last time you heard or saw a mainstream news report about government officials lying that did not concern their sex lives or personal vices? If one wants to get a more complete picture of U.S. government policy objectives and the U.S. role in the world, one frequently has to look to media sources outside the United States. Tonight we're going to look at some of the issues surrounding so-called free trade from a Canadian perspective. In the first hour, we'll broadcast part of a series of radio documentaries, Free Thought Area of the Airwaves, produced at CKLN, the radio station of Ryerson College in Toronto. Then, a talk by Canadian economist Michelle Chisadovsky from the University of Ottawa that addresses the real purpose of so-called free trade agreements, the abridgment of democracy and the increase of corporate control of society.
Don't know good horse as we trot in this dark here.
This series of radio documentaries covers issues related to the proposed free trade area of the Americas, produced at CKLN FM Radio in Toronto, Canada, with support from the Center for Social Justice, Canadian Auto Workers, and the Ryerson Students Administrative Council.
There's nothing that's been officially put out on this. There's rarely been so much talk about a topic on which there's so little substance on paper.
This program looks at democracy and human rights and how they're affected by free trade agreements like the proposed FTAA. I'm Kristen Schwartz. For months, we've watched as Canadian police and military get ready for the Summit of the Americas in Quebec City, a fence several kilometers long to keep protesters away from the summit, 6,000 police, denial of visas to international observers and protesters. And yet, the Canadian authorities continue to assert that the Summit of the Americas and the proposed FTAA will enhance democracy and human rights in the hemisphere. In fact, Cuba's being excluded from the summit and the FTAA negotiations on the basis that its government is not democratically elected, according to the summit's definitions. So how does discussion of democracy fit into the summit and the FTAA? During the summit itself, human rights, civil rights, and political process will be discussed in the so-called democracy basket, chaired by Canada. But the main order of business for the summit is the FTAA. The draft texts that have been released so far include nothing specific about democracy, despite the repeated references by Jean Chrétien and other Canadian officials to a democracy clause. Diana Bronson is the globalization campaigner at Rights and Democracy, an organization established by an act of parliament 10 years ago, based in Montreal.
Unfortunately, there's been nothing really put forward on paper regarding the democracy clause and officially what it's going to be. What I glean from the various informal discussions that have taken place is that we're looking at a very limited definition of democracy, one which essentially is summarized in, you know, elections, that there's elections.
Margaret Villamizar works with the Windsor Peace Coalition. Last June, when the Organization of American States met in Windsor, the coalition organized teach-ins and protests.
I'm looking back to 1991 when all the countries that had before been under the Eastern European Socialist Bloc collapsed as socialist entities and they became eligible for membership in the new European Union. The idea was that basically everybody had to sign on to a Charter of Values that espoused American-style democracy, which they call representative democracy, and they had to hold elections in the context of political pluralism, and of course they all had to uphold the whole question of free markets, a market-based economy. And somewhere in all that, they've attempted to attach the notion of democracy and also human rights, the concept of human rights as it's interpreted, I think, rather selectively also by the Americans and Canada and other countries in that alliance. They've attached that somehow to the concept of a market economy, as if Canada were the model of democracy, like anyone who's had chance to look at the way elections are run in Canada or in the U.S., of course, can see that it's money that determines many, many things. We don't have any real organic connection to the people who make the decisions on our behalf, which are often appointed officials actually at cabinet level and other organizations away from the people. And this kind of a system is being held up as a democracy, while the Cubans, who actually do have a whole electoral process in place where they select their own candidates, that's somehow not considered valid. Some press report actually put forward the straight-out lie that in Cuba they don't have elections. So this is the kind of thing that's being done, even, you know, outright mistruths being used to put forward the idea that somehow you can use the notion of democracy or free elections to accomplish another aim, which is, in my opinion, also to undermine the rights of nations to determine their own kind of system that they want to live in and their own kind of society.
We've worked on democratic issues in our center for about 10 years, and along with many other organizations have a somewhat more complex definition of democracy, which is indeed based on international human rights instruments. While elections are very important and a necessary condition for democracy, we don't think that that's a sufficient condition. And we also have to look at issues like the independence of the judiciary, the distribution of wealth, minority rights, collective rights, social, economic, and cultural rights. There's a whole list of criteria that should be fulfilled, and we shouldn't just say that democracies are equal to elections.
From that perspective, Rights and Democracy has analyzed the potential impact of the FTAA on democracy in the Americas.
We've looked at potential implications for the rights of political dissent. That's the whole question around the Quebec summit, the wall, the police presence, the denial of visas and so on that's going on right now. But we've also looked at the actual impacts of trade liberalization on the right to health, on the right to food, and the right to education. We don't think that the human rights issues involved in this trade agreement can be adequately dealt with through a single clause. What we would like to see in international trade, and this goes for the FTAA and WTO and others, is a human rights framework. We believe trade is not an end in itself, it's a means to an end. And the end is the fuller realization of human rights for all human beings on this planet, and we've got to start showing progress towards that. So in order to have a human rights framework for trade, we need to strengthen the human rights institutions that don't have the resources and the political backing that they require to effectively do their job, because all the energy is going towards these trade agreements. We believe that the primacy of international human rights law has to be recognized within the trade agreement itself, and that specific international human rights treaties have to be referred to in the agreement, and that the states which have not ratified those agreements should do so. And then we can talk about economic integration, where the goals of economic integration will not be increased profits for a few in the hope that that's going to trickle down and somehow better life for the majority, but that the explicit goal should be a better life for the majority and the delivery of the services that people need in order to fully realize their human rights on an equitable basis.
Rebecca Tababadong, Wasaxan First Nation, looks at the political institutions in the Americas from the perspective of Indigenous peoples who continue to struggle to maintain and rebuild their traditional governments.
Chrétien also talks about the democracy clause. For civil society, this might sound like progress, but we as Aboriginal people in Canada know all too well the effects of having our traditional governments replaced by imposed alien democratic band councils. The World Bank says it will bring Indigenous people into the 21st century. Again, this is espousing the internalized racism that views traditional Indigenous governments and way of life as primitive. These communities will be granted the great privilege of Western democracy and lining up to vote once every 4 years. In Canada and throughout the Americas, there's also the issue of treaties. Under trade rules, once again, our history doesn't matter anymore. Canada has a lot of unfinished business with First Nations. Our nations are not a party in these negotiations, yet they will undoubtedly threaten First Nations jurisdiction of land ownership, management, and resource extraction. I wonder what weight modern treaties such as New Chanoth Agreement in principle just negotiated, the Nishka Self-Government Agreement, and negotiations all across Canada will carry under these new trade rules. Will our nations be sued by groups such as Bechtel Corp for refusing to sell our water down south? The Great Lakes have never been surrendered by treaty. The Great Lakes account for 20% of this planet's fresh water supply, while another 20% lies in the Amazon. Who does the water belong to? Canada said it will not allow bulk exports of water. Now Canada is being sued for not selling water.
Reflecting on the 500-year history of colonial rule in the Americas allows us to focus on how democratic institutions and movements can be limited, coerced, and contained by raw economic, political, and military power. Margaret Villamizar gives an example from Ecuador about how an elections-based definition of democracy can be used against popular movements.
Well, just over a year, I think it was last January, in Ecuador, January 2000, there was a large uprising of people which formed around a very large militant indigenous movement, and it was joined by workers as well as some sections of the military that were quite dissatisfied with the state of affairs in their country. And one of the big culminating incidents, I guess, was the announced intent of the government of the day to dollarize the economy. That is, you know, introduce basically the American value to replace the national currency in Ecuador, which was again part of submitting to the structural adjustment plans of the International Monetary Fund. People were very much opposed to that because they were already impoverished. They were already seeing their country's sovereignty being basically bargained away, and they said, enough of that, we don't want this. So they rose up and they actually occupied the parliament for a period of time. They actually forced the resignation of the president of the day, who resigned himself, actually. He was not, you know, acted upon in violence or whatever. Now, I think there was a group of three individuals who formed like a temporary junta, as it might have been called, to replace the government, were considered to be illegitimate by the Americans and by the Organization of American States, and of course by Canada, who very quickly came in and said, you people are in violation of the constitution of your country. Either you reinstate someone from the elected parliament, in that case, put in the vice president after the president resigned, or you are going to be subject to, anyway, I don't know if they were so explicit, but they made it clear that sanctions or blockade of the type that Cuba is subjected to will be applied to you. So either you do what we say, or you're not part of the hemisphere and you're going to be isolated. So that was held up high by the Americans, by the Canadian government and others as being a perfect example of how the insistence on democracy prevails. Well, in fact, in my opinion, what they were doing was they were holding to some formalistic things of a constitution and laws to legitimize something that's content was totally undemocratic. That is the way the interests of the people were being sold out, as they thought, by the regime that eventually resigned. So I have no doubt that the new democracy resolution, which they hope to agree on at the summit in Quebec, will be used just in that way to coerce and threaten countries that they feel are not, you know, in line with the agenda of the free trade area of the Americas, or some other aspect of it, they're going to be subjected to threats.
Canada is also subject to the dictates of the IMF and the World Bank. Last fall, the Ecumenical Coalition for Economic Justice in Toronto obtained through the Freedom of Information Act evidence of IMF influence on the Canadian federal budget of 1995. John Dillon describes.
What we found is that annually the IMF sends a team of economists to Canada to evaluate our programs. And until recently, their reports were always kept secret. But what happened is, through a Freedom of Information request, we obtained copies of the reports leading up to the 1995 budget. And they're quite devastating, not because of the predictable ideological bent of the IMF, which of course is very conservative and calls for cutbacks in spending, but because of the detail of the advice they give to rearrange Canada's social programs. Well, the 1995 budget was quite fundamental, because that's when Canada backed away from many of our historic commitments to redistribution and social justice. and began to dismantle some of our core social programs. That included reforms to the unemployment insurance system, abolishing the Canada Assistance Plan, and the formula for funding of federal transfers to the provinces for health and post-secondary education. So it's had a far-reaching effect, and even though some of the funding's been restored, our social programs still are not back in the shape they were prior to 1995. The ideology of the IMF represents the interests of a very powerful corporations and financial institutions. And these are the same institutions that are sponsoring the free trade area of the Americas and other trade agreements. And I think we recently saw a very critical example of the assault on democracy in Canada, where it was revealed that some of these corporations, by paying money to the federal government, will have direct access to the 34 heads of state and heads of government coming to Quebec City for the summit. Access that will be denied to citizens' groups who will be kept on the other side of a wall reinforced by 5,000 and now 6,000 police officers. So democracy in Canada, it looks like it's for sale when you can buy your way into a summit. And this is very scary for democracy.
The key to democracy for me is the question of the people themselves being sovereign in any given country. And that would involve the people themselves have to be the ones who are truly participating in decision-making of all in all the important spheres of life. That would mean, like in elections, that people don't have the role of money, they don't have the role of vested interest with political parties that basically usurp their role, that people themselves are actually enabled to pick their own representatives properly, elect them, and then control them after that in ways that actually mean something. To me, that would be a democratic form that we would have to have before we can actually claim to stand up and teach anybody anything about democracy. And we're far from that right now.
This program looks at agriculture in the proposed FTAA with Maude Barlow, Terry Norman, Devlin Koyak, and Cecilia Rocha. I'm Christiana Clemens. The proposed free trade area of the Americas is being negotiated through 9 negotiating groups. One of those groups deals specifically with agriculture. I asked Maude Barlow, chair of the Council of Canadians, what the mandate of the negotiating group on agriculture is.
Well, their mandate is corporatization of food production. I mean, we're seeing a shift in all of our countries from agriculture as providing food for people to profits for food corporations. And you get bigger, you die. I mean, I've watched in Canada, I've actually just saw a chart the other day where it shows our agricultural exports just in the last 10 years just exponentially jumping off the page. And then on the same chart was the return to the farm gate to the 270,000 farm families. And it's just like right down at the bottom and just falling off. The lowest return to the farm gate since 1926 when they first started keeping statistics in this country.
I deal with negotiation of trade agreements and so on, but don't really deal directly with land ownership or farm income issues.
Terry Norman is Canada's lead negotiator for agriculture for the FTAA.
I mean, certainly in general, we're moving constantly towards fewer farms and bigger farms, and the basic farming structure in Canada still is family-owned farms, but over time they're getting bigger and more expensive to run. I'm not sure that I can say too much more than that.
We've had a real transformation in Canada away from small farming, away from any forms of local community-based agriculture and food systems towards more industrial, export-led, and highly chemically dependent farm systems.
Devlin Koyak works with the belly of resistance to the FTAA.
And that's been, I think, a very deliberate policy by federal governments, provincial governments, and industry over the years. And farmers haven't done much of a job in collectively resisting it either. There have been some very progressive farmers' organizations throughout the years, but they haven't had much success in stemming the tide. And these agreements like NAFTA, like the FTAA, the WTO agreement on agriculture, they're all part of that trend, part of that push towards export-led agriculture that's corporate-controlled, that really benefits the elite and the big companies in various countries. Export-led agriculture is not something that benefits small farmers.
The policies that you had in Mexico to protect small producers and family farms were completely undermined under the NAFTA agreement. First of all, because a lot of the organizations that used to do that in Mexico, they were privatized under the NAFTA agreement.
Cecilia Rocha is a professor of economics at Ryerson University. She has been researching issues of food security in Brazil.
And a lot of the privatizing organizations then, instead of having the focus of helping the small farmers, they changed the focus in terms of profit. And that reduced the availability of that service to the small farmers. So the implementation of NAFTA resulted in an increasing trade deficit in food with the United States, whose food exports to Mexico increased because the small farmers, who were a major producer of food, they were undermined, so that reduced the production of small farmers. And a lot of the products that they used to produce in Mexico, they started to import from the United States. So in terms of Mexico, under NAFTA, that study suggests that there are some significant costs, and those costs are borne by low-income small farmers. There is no reason to think that in the case of Brazil would be any different. If the negotiations are moving along the same lines as under NAFTA and other free trade agreements. The Brazilian government is concerned about the effect on agriculture of a free trade agreement, not necessarily because it's going to affect small producers, but because it's going to affect big producers. In the same way as the United States and Canada are concerned about the big producers.
You know, a farmer now needs hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of equipment in order to farm larger acreages and be competitive, whereas it used to be that farmers could farm on a much smaller scale and make money, but now it's a major business investment to operate a farm. It's not just a way of life anymore.
The notion has changed from food security, meaning you can grow enough food to feed your people, to being that you can afford to buy food wherever it's grown more cheaply. And that's a recipe for bad food, bad trade, imbalance in who gets access to food and who doesn't, and a total corporate control of our food process.
It's hard to tell exactly what the FTA will mean because the text hasn't been decided on and, you know, may not even happen. But from what we can see from the American proposals, also from the Canadian proposals that are out there already, is that they want to use the FTA to, on the one hand, expand markets for genetically modified organisms. So in agriculture, that's your food crops. And Argentina, U.S., and Canada are the major producers.
The main objective of these negotiations is to achieve better access to the markets of the other countries of the hemisphere, in particular the Brazilian market.
You have a law that you cannot produce transgenic food in Brazil. You can have experimental farms or experimental production, but you cannot produce commercially. And Brazil is one of the few countries where grain production is not majorly affected by transgenics. Now, of course, there are a number of products that are imported or manufactured that already have transgenic ingredients on them. What's happening is that locally, you have a number of movements in Brazil to ban those products. And in the city of Belo Horizonte, which you have a very active government in food security, they simply banned the sale of products with genetically modified ingredients. So a lot of manufactured industrialized goods are now banned for sale in that city.
And of course you're seeing all these problems now with countries rejecting it, or they have apprehensions about allowing GMOs into their food system. But with the FTA, what the idea is that you would harmonize regulations throughout the Americas to conform to American and Canadian standards, which is basically this idea of substantial equivalence, where genetically modified food is the same thing as a traditional crop, as long as there's no scientific evidence to the contrary. And because there's no studies done, it's very hard to prove that. So really, it's forcing open countries' markets to genetically modified crops and destroying their regulatory sovereignty, their ability to say yes or no to foods. And under the Canadian proposal, it actually would submit regulatory policy to the WTO. It would be actually the WTO that would be the one who could finally decide on whether or not a country had to accept a genetically modified crop or food. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, you're seeing in the Canadian and American proposals, primarily because those are the ones that are available, a push towards, and this is mostly in the American proposal, a push towards patenting of life. Americans have been a little bit frustrated by the WTO process around the intellectual property rights as it concerns agriculture, because it allows, under the WTO, there's an exemption for plants and animals. Now, under the American proposal, what would end up happening is that exemption that exists under the WTO would simply be eliminated in the countries of the Americas, so that all countries would have to grant patents over plants, over animals, and there's a lot of consequences with that. The verdict on the Percy Schmeiser case was announced. He's the farmer from Bruno, Saskatchewan, who was accused of saving Monsanto's seeds illegally from year to year. And the judge ended up ruling that Monsanto's patents were applicable to Percy Schmeiser's plants, even though he had not purchased Monsanto seeds, but because he had genes that were patented by Monsanto in his crops, even if they had come through cross-pollination, that it was his fault for growing them, and they were the property of Monsanto, so he had them illegally. That's really an unprecedented step, and the FTA is just going to put pressure on Canada to continue in that direction.
Really, the world is still coming to grips with what the interrelationship or interface should be between intellectual property rights and trade. It's not really an agriculture-specific issue, although recently it certainly has also become an agricultural issue because of the genetically modified products and seeds and various specialized products that are used in agriculture. Not very much. I'm not very competent in this area, I'm afraid, and it's a much broader issue than just agriculture, there's a whole broad range of intellectual property issues.
I think what happens, and I know that what happens in most countries, is they don't have the faintest idea. Most other politicians or other departments don't have the faintest idea what's going on. They think that they're in charge of their portfolio. And meanwhile, those issues are being negotiated at another realm and another level altogether. So what's happening is the whole notion of owning farmers around the world and forcing them to buy seeds back and buy to be able to plant their seeds the next year, which is anathema to the entire third world. I mean, it's just never the way you've done this. Anathema here to many farmers too, but many have bought in as well.
When you think about agriculture, you can't just think about food crops either. It goes into things like agricultural inputs like fertilizers and pesticides and seeds, and also the entire food processing industry, the retailing industry. That's a major, major area of concern for all countries in the Americas. And I think one of the reasons why it would be an important or a high priority agenda item is that there's been so much turmoil within the WTO surrounding agriculture. And there's been a lot of proposals by countries of the South to have a review on the agriculture agreement in the WTO because it is so one-sided. It really was just, in the WTO, was an agreement basically between the EU and the U.S. that while it completely penalized southern countries and forced open their markets with destructive consequences for small farmers, it allowed the EU and the US to maintain their levels of support to farmers. And these are ways that they support their farmers that no country in the South can afford to imitate, and they're not even allowed to under the WTO. So a lot of countries in the South have serious problems with the agriculture agreement, and they're looking to renegotiate it.
It's been agreed since the beginning of the negotiations that all of the participants want to eliminate export subsidies for agricultural products traded within the hemisphere. So there's been discussion of various ideas of how to go about doing that. A number of countries, in particular the South American countries, want to deal with domestic support and subsidization issues, whereas Canada and the United States and some of the other participants think the World Trade Organization is a better place to deal with those. But, I mean, the two main users of agricultural subsidization are the European Union and the United States, but disciplines that would be contained in the FTAA would only apply to the FTAA countries and not to the European Union. What we've proposed in the FTAA is that the FTAA countries should cooperate in the WTO to achieve our desired objectives there, where some of the other countries are suggesting that the FTAA agreement itself should contain disciplines on domestic subsidies. So that's the substantive difference in the discussion so far.
Now, if you can, in the FTAA, come with an agreement that goes further than the agriculture agreement, and really, under the WTO, any multilateral agreement can only be recognized if it goes further than what the WTO does. It has to be a sort of WTO plus. So if you can negotiate a WTO plus agreement for agriculture with all these countries in the Americas, that's going to put significant pressure. It's going to give you a very strong platform from which to launch a more penetrating agreement in agriculture, or at least to stop the tide of resistance to the agreement of agriculture in the WTO.
Brazil is the main other force to contend with, you know, because it's the second largest economy in the Americas, and it does have a very independent foreign trade position. It's very pragmatic, has always been, you know, it wants to sell. It wants to sell abroad. It sells a lot to Europe, a lot to Asia, has good trade relations with Africa, so it's diversified. It does not depend only on trade within the Americas. It certainly has a lot of trade with the United States. There are very specific issues that Brazil wants to negotiate. So it comes to the agreements with a very pragmatic kind of attitude. You know, it's not so much ideological. It's not here because it believes free trade is best. I think it comes because it will see. Where can we gain from that?
In the negotiations of the FTA, we haven't yet got into detailed discussions of market access issues. There's no specifics yet of which products are most sensitive or how fast tariffs should be reduced and so on. What we're talking about so far on market access issues is what are called methods and modalities. And these are such issues as what base tariff rate should you start from to make your reductions? What kind of time period should you make reductions over? So it's those kinds of technical negotiating issues that are being discussed so far, not what we will actually do at the end of the negotiations and what the result will be.
This is not about drugs. Drugs is a cover story.
They've made the space, the beautiful territory of one of the most marvelous lands in the world, into a space they want to destroy.
KRS-One coming through, Big Zach, Last Emperor. That's the sound of EMS.
Uncle Sam's War on Drugs, the FTAA, and Plan Colombia. We'll try and bring it all together right here on CKLM Radical Radio.
This voice shatters the calm of the day like an alarm. So wake up, battered youth, and take up arms. Cause more is necessary than vocabulary war. Cause a toxic rock imports hitting on your door. CIA, I see you later. Cause your time is coming soon. I flip this shit like Pacino when it's your dog day afternoon. At a-
there are two conditions essential for capital's expansion. Two, non-negotiable. One is taking on resources, as many as they can, as quickly as they can, space, geography, life, and then turn them into commodities, transform them, and sell them for profit. That's one condition. The other condition, non-negotiable, is that they have to make somebody work to transform those resources into what they can sell in markets for profit. And those are people. They have to turn people into workers, into machines that transform things, that take on space, that destroy space for profit. And if those two things are cheap or free, then they accumulate profit. They're sick. They're vultures taking people and turning them into slaves and taking space and destroying them and turning them into merchandise in markets. As they destroy their own territories and their own land and turn their own people into machines of production, they need more space, more territory, more people. That's what's going on in Colombia. They've made those people and life there cheap for their own interests. And they've made the space, the beautiful territory of one of the most marvelous lands in the world, into a space they want to destroy. If the US gets away with Plan Colombia, with free trade, there only will be deserts where there once was the most beautiful life anywhere. There only will be slaves where there were once the most beautiful and free, diverse cultures in the whole continent. Plan Colombia, free trade are exactly the same. They're about greed for some to accumulate profit. Freedom is the opposite of this disaster.
As free market capitalism and technology expands, the third world fertile soil becomes a desert wasteland. So it takes fans to demand the government provide answers. When Lady Liberty has me bewitched like Samantha, and poverty is one of the most malignant forms of cancer. To all my black magic romancers and acid rain dancers, develop close ties like Jerry Seinfeld.
Milo Kiyokeyu of the Mapuche people of Chile.
The Uva case is a typical case of how the indigenous people are right now. We are threatened by the globalization. So it's not only in Colombia, but all over the continent. The companies are going over into indigenous territories and trying to exploit what they call the natural resources. And they're taking the oil mining and lumber, so, and exploiting the rivers, and there's a lot of contamination. So the Uba traditional people, who are very strong people, who are very, have very strong, beautiful culture, they have been threatened for years by the company, but also the mining, by the many outsiders who are trying to, you know, get their territories. So they've been fighting.
Berito Cuar Ua and Gilberto Covarria of the Ua people of the Cloud Forest in Colombia. Translation by Milo Keokiu of the Mapuche people of Chile.
We are the Ua people. We are threatened right now by the government, not only materially but also psychologically, and now trying to take our territory. So we are fighting because we want to have justice in Colombia, and right now we are organizing to fight back because the government and the Oxy from the United States Oil Corporation is trying to, they are continuing exploring the territory, and when we protest in the Colombian government throughout the military are repressing us. He said that throughout the Plan Colombia, which is after the name the United States government called the aid to Colombia, $1.6 billion, the aid to Colombia. He said that basically in the past, that money, any aid, international aid, especially from the United States, has been used to bombard indigenous people and peasant poor people to repress them. And we don't want to that, and we want to ask the government, the United States and the Colombian government, the international, to use the money in the good way, but I don't think so, because I think they are going to bombard the people again, they will repress the people again, the indigenous people and the peasants in Colombia.
Professor Noam Chomsky.
In 1999, atrocities increased sharply, almost 80% of them attributed to the paramilitary-military alliance, and again conforming to traditional patterns. A U.S. arms flow increased, in fact tripled, and it's now scheduled to rise even more sharply under the pretext of a drug war.
Stan Goff, former member of the U.S. Special Forces in Colombia.
You know, we're continually talking about drugs, and I think it's important to point out some of the contradictions in this official story. But this involvement in Colombia, and this is really, really important to understand, has nothing to do with drugs. This, you know, if you want to stop drug flow all over the world, the first place to drop a bomb would be Langley, Virginia, because the CIA has been involved with the support and arming of more drug cartels than any other organization in history. So, but this is not about drugs. Drugs is a cover story. When we were deployed down there in 1992, when my team went down in 1992 to help integrate the staffs of the Colombian Air Force and the Colombian Army to start conducting night heliborne operations with the Special Forces units that were stationed at Colombian Special Forces in Tolimaida, we were briefed before we got on the ground that on the drug story, and we were briefed on it as a story. This is what you tell people if they ask you about this mission. In fact, first of all, none of us were qualified to do any kind of anti-narcotics operation. That's not the doctrine that we're qualified to teach. We teach light infantry doctrine, and we were specifically teaching light infantry counterinsurgency doctrine. But that would have created some political difficulties, and it still would create some political difficulties. And you have to find out what's the real interest, and I think what the gentleman said earlier is correct. You have to sort of look at the flow of money to figure that out. What I've been doing as a job since I got out of the Army is doing work around money and politics research and advocacy. And if you look at who the major contributors are, if you want to know why you can't get people elected who won't go against the flow on this stuff, you need to find out who the interests are who are paying for the campaigns. Weapons industry, the oil industry, the banking and brokerage houses, these are the major contributors to both parties. So what they do is they present you with a choice between two people who really represent the same interest. They're in competition with one another for that job, but they really represent the same interest, all their demagogy aside.
In southern Colombia, there's an area called Putumayo, which is the target of Plan Colombia. Fumigation and bullets are being thrown at indigenous communities and poor peasants that live there. And under that beautiful land, there is oil. And more than 80% of the oil in that territory has been contracted out to Canadian companies for extraction and exploration. So where people are going to be displaced by Plan Colombia, where people are being murdered by Plan Colombia, right there in that same territory, there is oil that will benefit and profit for Canadian corporations like Talisman, Alberta Energy Consortium, Occidental Canada, TransCanada Pipelines, and Enbridge, among many others. There's mining in Colombia. There's a lot of gold where there is war in Colombia. The Canadian International Development Agency funded experts that transformed the mining code in Colombia, so that prior consultation with communities that live in regions where there is gold could be bypassed, so that the profit could flow by displacing people from the regions. So oil, flowers, coffee, gold, and gasoline that you get in Canada, they all have a huge hidden price in blood, suffering, and displacement. More than 2 million Colombians have been displaced by force. Their territory has been liberated for the interests of capital. That is much many more people than Kosovo, and nobody cares. Maybe nobody cares because most of them are indigenous and black people. Most of them are women and children. And who cares about black Indians and black children?
Need I say the CIA be criminals in action? Cocaine crack unpacking, high surveillance tracking. Prominent blacks and whites giving orders for mass slaughters. I want all my daughters to be like Maxine Waters. When they flooded the streets with crack cocaine, I was like Noah. Now they lower, cause the whole Cold War is over. Communism fell to the dollars you were grabbing it. All the assault and battering in the name of intelligence gathering. Now it's karma you battling or losing fight. I choose the mic to recite, ignite light in the night.
In the 1991 Constitution of Colombia, a new constitution was brought up as a part of a peace agreement with the rebel groups in Colombia. And indigenous people and black people won, for the first time, recognition of, as people. Only in 1991, black and indigenous communities were recognized as being human. They were subhuman before 91. And one of the components of the recognition was the recognition to their territory. Their territorial rights were recognized so nobody could take resources from indigenous and black communities without prior consultation to them. Given that formally they have that right, and that free trade is against that, like NAFTA was against the rights of Zapatistas and Mayas in Mexico, what the Colombian government has resorted to is, on the one hand, trying to reform the legislation, but that is difficult to do. So they allow that formally black and indigenous people are entitled to their land. At the same time, paramilitary groups are formed and they're being displaced from their land. So now you have black people in cities starving to death, holding titles to land that they're rightly and legally theirs, but they're being displaced by force and by murder. There is violence in Colombia precisely so that that legislation is not abided by or not protected.
Sí, mira, si nosotros
podemos decir, you know, this is from 15 years to now, there's a big change in Colombia. This is that what's more contaminated right now, there's more pollution, because these corporations are moving to our territory. It didn't happen before because we have very clean territory, very clean water. It was a good place to live. And you don't know how much the violence has increased in our territory. There's different forces, different groups fighting each other. And so we have been under the crossfire, victimized by those groups. So there's so much violence going on that our life is at risk all the time, every minute. We have God, our creator, Sira, and our mother has been violated, has been raped, and we don't accept that. We won't permit that. So that way we are fighting, because not only for the territory, but also for our people, for spiritual life. So that's why we stand up today and to defend our territory.
This program was produced as part of the Free Thought Area of the Airwave series, with research, recording, and production by
Kristen Schwartz,
Christiana Clemens,
Antonia Baker,
Greg Duffel,
Susie Alvarez,
Mona Gupta,
Bernie Munich,
and Kathy Cumberland.
Music by Miss KLC and Jackson Two Bears. Produced with support from the Center for Social Justice, Canadian Auto Workers, and the Ryerson Students Administrative Council.
You can download this program at radioforall.net.
For more information about this series, contact Kristen Schwartz or Christiana Clemens at CKLN Radio Incorporated, 380 Victoria Street, Toronto, Ontario, M5B1W7.
Our phone number is 416-595-5068.
Fax 416-595-0226.
Email ckln-news@sac.ryerson.ca.
Visit our website at www.ckln.sac.ryerson.ca.
Thank you for listening.
The people who tout free trade also give a lot of lip service to the free market. The theory of the free market is that anyone may produce a product to sell. Buyers will choose among the competing products, and those who sell what the buyers want will become successful. Advertising of the product's virtues or alleged virtues is an integral part of this system. One frequently hears claims of the juiciest burger, the special additive that gets clothes cleaner, and so on. None of these products have been compelled to include language in their ads or packaging that state that a U.S. government agency has determined that their burger is identical to other burgers, or that their detergent cleans no better than their competitors, even though this may actually be the case. Yet, when it comes to the genetically engineered bovine growth hormone known as RBGH, produced by Monsanto, which is given to cows to increase milk production, the rules change abruptly. RBGH has faced serious public opposition since it was licensed. Dairies who rejected the use of RBGH and labeled their packages accordingly were told by the government that they must include a disclaimer which states that the FDA had determined that there was no difference between milk from treated and untreated cows. The fact is, there is a difference, and the U.S. is one of only a handful of industrial countries that allows the sale of milk produced from cows treated with RBGH. Canada, in deciding several years ago to continue its ban on RBGH, criticized the United States for the poor quality of the studies it had relied upon to approve its use. The person in charge of the approval of RBGH at the FDA was a former employee of Monsanto. The European Union went even further in its criticism, citing concerns about significant health risks posed to humans. Milk from cows treated with RBGH contains elevated levels of insulin growth factor, a natural hormone which has been implicated in breast, prostate, and colorectal cancer. Measures to require labeling of products containing GMOs have met with fierce resistance from the biotech industry and from government bodies. Why? Don't these free marketeers think they can compete with non-GMO foods? Maybe not, since organic farming is the fastest-growing sector in the farm economy, and the demand for organic foods worldwide far outstrips the supply. So much for the free market. More than 50 genetically engineered crop plants have been approved by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, including potatoes, corn, tomatoes, melons, and beets. USDA does not presently require any health or safety tests before genetically engineered crops are marketed, leaving it to the biotech firms to decide whether they are safe. And those crops appear in the grocery store without you having any way of knowing which they are. There are now two bills related to GMOs in the state legislature that are facing stiff opposition, both from biotech and agribusiness lobbies. One of those bills, Assembly Bill 3586, would require labeling of milk containing RBGH. Another bill, known as McEnany-Laval, would place a 5-year moratorium on the planting of GMO crops in New York State and give the government and researchers time to evaluate the potential risks to human health and the environment. The legislation would also require the State Department of Agriculture and Markets to prepare a marketing plan that uses the moratorium as a promotional tool for New York State agricultural products. Due to the prevalence of GMO contamination of non-GMO crops in the United States, European Union countries no longer buy U.S. agricultural products, which represents a loss of more than $200 million to U.S. farmers. Those who support the GMO moratorium and the labeling of milk containing RBGH should write or call their state assembly members and state senator as soon as possible.
I used to feel safe here. These are the flowers and the trees I grew up with. But now as I'm walking through these fields I have known, I'm wondering which way the wind has blown. Something's changed, something strange you rearranged, and I don't remember asking you. Something's changed, something's strange. Children as tomorrows will always be blessed by your irreversible test. And if I wanted Frankenstein, I'd reach Shelley, and I'd put him in my belly. And if I wanted transgenic honey, I'd call Mother and Scully. Oh, something's
You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse.